Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, January 12th, 2015. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, we'll talk with Scott Chambor and Karen Nelson about Project Homeless Connect. Guitarist Dan Hobson will offer a preview of his Monday one-night stand presentation at the Jack. We'll talk to Colette Costa about the disappearance of 35mm film. And we'll get the details about the upcoming Writers' Showcase. Those interviews, Writers' Almanac, Bird Note, National Native News, music, and more right here on a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A new report by Human Rights Watch alleges that the Lower Brule Sioux tribal government in South Dakota has compromised the human rights of its citizens. Tristan Autone reports.
The report, Secret and Unaccountable, the Tribal Council at Lower Brule and its Impact on Human Rights, found that between 2007 and 2013, over $20 million in funds meant for essential services were diverted and unaccounted for. Those funds were meant for services like education and economic development, and Human Rights Watch says as a result, tribal members' human rights have been restricted. The most glaring situation outlined by the report included the purchase of a New York-based brokerage firm called WestRock Advisors in 2009. According to Human Rights Watch, members of the Lower Brule Tribal Council set up shell companies to secure loans from the Bureau of Indian Affairs and diverted funds from tribal social programs in order to buy WestRock. In 2011, the firm declared bankruptcy, leaving tribal members, investors, and taxpayers on the hook. In another instance, the Lower Brule Tribal Council diverted nearly $3 million in federal funds meant for reservation schools to the tribe's general fund and has still not been accounted for. That same year, the report's authors found that only about one quarter of students on the reservation were proficient or advanced in reading and math. The Lower Brule Reservation is home to nearly 2,000 people. Human Rights Watch says that the reservation has been under the same government leadership since 1980, and that to prevent further problems, officials should follow tribal law and publish past and current tribal council resolutions and meeting minutes, as well as open investigations into the tribe's programs and business dealings. The group also recommends the federal government delay funding to the tribal council if leadership refuses to be accountable or transparent. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Autone.
We reached out to the tribe for comment and did not receive a response. In Idaho, several tribes have sent a letter to state officials urging them to stop the increasing number of instant racing machines. Reporter Steve Jackson has more.
The instant racing machines became legal after the state legislature authorized a bill in 2013. The machines are being operated at several sites around the state, including the Greyhound Park in Post Falls. The machines use videos of various unidentified horse races that players bet on. Coeur d'Alene Tribal spokeswoman Heather Keene says the law allows for the machines to be less regulated than the betting machines that the tribes operate.
They just installed 50 down in Idaho Falls, and then I believe Post Falls Greyhound Park has about 35 right now. But there's potential for one in each county with an unlimited number of machines, and that's a pretty stark contrast to tribes who are allowed to have gaming on the reservation, obviously. And then there's also we have in our gaming compact a limit on the number of machines we can put in.
The Coeur d'Alene tribe joined several others in sending a letter to Idaho Governor Butch Otter and State Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin to stop the proliferation of such machines. Heather Keene says other states, including Maryland, Wyoming, and Kentucky, have found those machines to be illegal. For National Native News, I'm Steve Jackson reporting from Spokane.
On Saturday, Navajo Nation President Ben Shelley signed into law legislation for the special runoff election for the office of president and vice president. The Navajo Nation Council approved the bill last month. The presidential election was postponed in November and since has played out in tribal government and court. After the August primary, one of the top two candidates was disqualified. His Navajo language fluency was challenged. The runoff election is now scheduled for June, in which the 17 contenders who originally ran are eligible to reapply. The special general election will proceed in August, and the swearing-in of a new president will take place in September. In the meantime, Shelley will remain as leader and is set to take oath of office tomorrow. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
The Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes to Albuquerque the Tribal Telecom May 4th, weaving pathways across the digital divide. Information on services and Tribal Telecom 2015 at ahcnm.org. Are you an experienced journalist who can lead radio producers and reporters in best practices and bring native voices to a wide audience? Kawanak Broadcast Corporation seeks an executive producer, program manager. Full description at nativeamericacalling.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, January 12th, 2015. It's about 6 minutes after the hour. And in the studio now is Kara Nelson and Scott Chambor, and we are here to talk about the Juno Coalition on Housing and Homelessness, and specifically Project Homeless Connect. Kara, Scott, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
Yeah, nice to have you both here. So you both wear so many hats in this community and are related to this project in many ways. Scott, you're a planner for the state, and you're the chair of the Juno or the Alaska Coalition on Housing and Homeless.
Yep.
And you take it from there. What else?
Sure. So, and have had participated with this project since its inception 5 years ago, working with the local coalition to put on Project Homeless Connect.
Okay. And Kara, how about you? What all hats do you wear?
Well, I'm the director at Haven House, Juno, a transitional home for women coming out of prison, as well as the Juno Reentry Coalition, just really, you know, focusing on the barriers coming out of prison and different things there, especially homelessness and housing, and the Juno Recovery Community, and just really having that open for many different things, including homelessness and housing.
Okay. And so what unites you two here today is the Juno Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. You're both a part of that.
Yep.
And this event coming up on January 28th called Project Homeless Connect. Scott, can you give us a little background on this?
Definitely. So Project Homeless Connect, this is going to be our fourth event in the past 5 years. And it really serves two purposes for our community. One, it's on-the-spot provision of services, kind of engagement with folks who are currently experiencing homelessness. We have about 50 service providers, as well as 25 or 30 healthcare providers in the past to provide on-the-spot assistance. And so that's the first function. And then the second function is this date coincides with the annual point-in-time homeless count. Around the country on this same day, everybody's counting the homeless populations in their community. And this is kind of an engagement tool for us to kind of gather that data so that we can work on behalf of this population moving forward.
This may be a big question. If you had to quantify the homelessness problem, let's just say in Juneau, in a short amount of time, how would you do that?
So I think, you know, I would refer to the annual point-in-time homeless count.
Yeah.
The Juno Homeless Coalition, the Juno Coalition on Housing and Homelessness, about 6 years ago really made a concerted effort to start taking the annual point-in-time count very seriously. And so in the year, I think it was, I have a nice table on a lot of the project sheets that I have that explain, you know, before we took it really seriously, we had an average of about 200 people that we counted as homeless. Once we combined making sure that the consistent agencies participated and held this event, it kind of moved up into that 500 range,
mm-hmm.
And it's kind of stayed there, and then that's kind of the assumption amongst coalition members that we're in the 500 to 600 range pretty consistently.
And that's part of what you'll be doing on at this event at the JAC, is doing that point-in-time survey. How exactly do you do that?
So there's a survey of about 15 questions.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically the first step of Project Homeless Connect is to kind of come through the door. We have a waiting room. We have snacks and coffee and tea and some music usually just to make people comfortable. And then we have volunteers usually a lot in the morning time because we have a huge rush in the morning. Who take the surveys, fill out the official point-in-time survey. And so that kind of goes in one direction. And then we also have the intake person also working with the person that day on what your needs are. Mm-hmm. And so there's another checklist to say, oh, do you want a foot massage? Do you need a haircut? Mm-hmm. Do you need a driver's license? And then that checklist is kind of gone through. And then that person is given their checklist and kind of guided to those services on the spot.
And speaking of those on-the-spot services, Kara, can you tell us a little bit about what you provide?
Well, there's going to be several providers there, anything from medical care, food and clothing vouchers, housing assistance, legal services, transportation, haircuts, and it's, you know, all of the information, as Scott was talking about, coming in is so essential to all these services for us to be a part of the solution and help really do something with the homeless population. And so there's, like what was already mentioned, the IDs, birth certificates, these are things that people cannot get a lot of times or don't have the resources to go in and get IDs. I know people coming out of prison, that's the number one thing, you know, to get a job or to move forward in other areas. So signing up for permanent fund, you know, registering to vote, lots more.
Okay.
Yeah, the other benefit of this day is almost as a peer networking session.
Yeah.
Because you have agencies from all around town who work with similar clients, but never get to see each other in the same room because they're with different agencies.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the main hall where everybody's getting services that day tends to be a huge networking opportunity as well.
You both seem very passionate about this. May I ask why you're interested in this and why should other people be interested in?
I'll go first. Well, I am a person with lived experience in prisons. I've been homeless before, you know, all of these different socioeconomic situations. And so that's where my real passion comes from, is just knowing how that connection really works to bring a hope that maybe was never there before, or just bring that there are people out there helping and they really do care in an authentic way.
Okay. How about you, Scott?
And I think, you know, in my role as kind of staff or chair of the Homeless Coalition to help devise this, I think it was my passion is helping clarify the problem.
Yeah.
And giving agencies the tools to alleviate some of the pressure, the problems in our community. My other passion, too, is the data component.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to be effective for any social concern, you have to have the personal story, but you also have the data to combine it. And so the events like this and the dedication of all the agencies to collect these pieces of information has led to the dialogues that we're having in the community today, which are, you know, aware, building more transitional housing, mm-hmm. St. Vincent de Paul pursuing low-income housing, and then the Glory Hole with their Housing First permanent supportive housing. You know, all of that doesn't take place unless these agencies are doing this background work.
Okay. Yeah. You said about 25 agencies are involved with the Juno Coalition on Housing and Homelessness?
Yep.
If folks are listening to the show right now and want to help, what can they do?
Well, they need to get a hold of Mandy Cole. You can reach her at 586-6623, and she's heading up the volunteer piece of it. Or Tamara and Sherry at the Alaska Housing
Development Corporation.
Thank you.
And Green Park.
Yes.
What kind of volunteering might they need?
So on the day of the event, there's really three roles that we've utilized in the past. And one I talked about is the intake surveys. So being on hand to fill out surveys, not only the official point in time count, but also the checklist of needs. Mm-hmm. And so that really is just, you know, sitting down and talking to people and being willing to listen and engage. The other role is to help a lot of folks have disabilities or need assistance in getting to the actual services in the facility in the JAC, and so we have a role of a guide, you know, people who kind of shuttle and work with people until, you know, they're finished with the event. And then the other one is just kind of a floater, you know, person to help with anything that might come up, you know, extra copies or, you know, there's a disruption somewhere in the facility to help mitigate some of that stuff.
Okay, and so this is on Wednesday, January 28th from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the JAC. If somebody wants more information, where should they go?
Yeah, so I think the contact is Tamara or Sherry at Greening Park Apartments, and their number is 780-6666. That's for the general information, and then they will guide you to wherever assistance is needed. I think by far, by experience, the most popular event of the day has been the haircuts.
Yeah.
We use the Zach Gordon Youth Center for that station. And so, you know, usually we have 4 to 6 haircutters at a time, and they pretty much go full on, and many years have extended their hours just to make sure people feel clean and tidy leaving the event.
Sure. All right, Scott Chambord, Kara Nelson, thanks for your time today. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
I'm walking through your town in the snow. I'm walking through your town in the snow. I got no place to go. Trains are running slow, and I'm walking through your town in the snow. I carry my home on my back. I carry my home on my back. But the police saw me frown every time I lay it down, and I'm walking. Don't these little winter towns all look the same? Don't these little winter towns all look the same? The freezing winds, they blow, and the mission doors are closed, and I'm walking through your town in the snow. It's getting late and all the bars are closed. It's so cold that I can't think. I could really use a drink. And I'm walking through your town in the snow. There's some fellas juggled up by the yard. There's some fellas jumbled up by the yard. They're cooking up down there, but I've nothing left to share, and I'm walking through your town in the snow. Maybe I can rustle up a job. Maybe I can rustle up a job. But there's nothing I can do. My best working days are through. And I'm walking through your town in the snow. Don't ever think I'll find a way back home. Don't think I'll ever find a way back home. I can see my golden years shining through the frozen tears. And I'm walking through your town in the snow. I'm walking through your town in the snow. I'm walking through your town in the snow. I've got no place to go. All the trains are running slow. And I'm walking through your town in the snow.
Hi, my name is Phil Paramore. I host Sound Means on Monday mornings at 10 a.m. on KRNN. I appreciate KRNN radio because it's fun, it's fresh, it's entertaining, and it's informative. Tune in to KRNN 102.7 FM. Thanks.
You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon on January 12th, 2015, Monday. It's about 20 minutes after the hour. And now in the studio is guitarist Dan Hobson. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks. Thanks for having me here, Scott.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. So you were the winner of an Individual Artists Award through the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's very, very generous of them. It was for a workshop that I attended in California. Alex DeGrassi, who a lot of people know from Windham Hill Recordings, does this every summer. He has usually about a dozen students come down, and some people come up over. They come from all over the country. I think we had a guy from Minnesota, was probably the farthest away this year. But generally, these are usually medium to advanced guitarists. All kinds of styles, but mostly people are looking to play Alex DeGrassi kind of style things, you know, open tunings, steel strings, stuff like that.
Okay, and you have listeners. Dan does have his guitar here with him today, and maybe in a minute, Dan, if we can get you to play us an example of that, that would be great. You've been in Juneau for a long time and been playing music. Tell us about it.
Yeah, I've been here 44 years now. I was pretty much a folkie back in the 70s. I worked on starting the folk festival, in fact, back in the mid-70s there. And, I didn't really get much into classical until I started playing with Linda Rosenthal. We toured around the state back in the late 70s. Then I took off and went to music school, figured I should probably study up a little bit. I did a one-year stint in Montana State, primarily to study with Christopher Parkening, classical guitarist there. So that was my big year of, you know, if you will, formal music studies. I was a biology major in college, so didn't get a lot of music. But I guess since then... I have taught out at UAS, and mostly for the last 9 years I've been playing regularly at the Baranoff Hotel on weekends, trying to keep kind of a broad repertoire, some classical, some popular, and anything from Renaissance to modern. So.
And you said back in the 70s you were a folkie.
Yeah, I had a big old Martin steel string guitar and played a lot of music like we came in on here, Utah Phillips there, but I was a finger picker, and this is what Alex DeGrassi's workshop is for finger style guitar, as opposed to, you know, people that use a flat pick and do fast flat picking like that. But this is finger style, which kind of meshes in with classical style. In fact, one of the interesting things about this was that I got looking at, as part of this preparation for this workshop, I got Alex DeGrassi's manual, his study manual, and lo and behold, a lot of the techniques are really familiar to me because of all the classical guitar that I've studied. So there's quite a crossover there.
You know, when I think about folk music, I think of it as something that you often hear and learn from hearing or being around other people. When I think of classical music, I often think of reading it off of a sheet. How does that resonate with you? How do you learn and thinking about your background in folk music compared to classical music? How do they mesh?
You know, I go all over the spectrum. I learned music at a real early age. I did piano and then brasses in school and stuff, so I was really comfortable with sheet music all the way through. And in fact, as I said, when I started playing with Linda Rosenthal, she just brought a whole bunch of piano scores over to me and said, think you can figure this out on guitar? And I said, yeah, probably. So I took off from there. Being able to play from by ear is also a tremendously useful thing. We have people that are pretty much addicted to what they call tablature, in other words, learning by the numbers. And most sheet music for guitar you see these days published will have a tablature score with it. So there's a lot of people that, as I say, just learn by numbers there. There's yet another way, which I just recently discovered, which is learning it off of YouTube.
Right.
I found this very fairly complex piece that I wanted to learn. I found a guy that played it on YouTube on a classical guitar. And fortunately, it was a full front shot of what everything he did, so I could watch everything that his hands did. And I thought, boy, that looks difficult. But once I thought, well, I could just back this up and go one frame at a time. And lo and behold, in about an hour, I had learned this piece, which it would have taken me weeks to go and learn the sheet music and then memorize it. But it took me a while to polish it, of course. But there, just by it's really an interesting way to approach it, just from watching somebody play it frame by frame like that.
Absolutely. Dan, you perform at the Baranoff, is that right? Often?
That's right, yeah, in the dining room, the Gold Room.
How often do you play there?
Friday and Saturday nights from 7 to 9 each night, year-round.
How long have you been doing that?
It'll be 9 years next month, yeah.
Wow.
Quite a while.
Yeah.
I think it's going on about 900 performances there, so.
Okay. Well, you have your guitar with you, and you're going to be doing your one-night stand presentation tonight at the Jack from 5 to 7. You want to describe what you're going to be doing tonight and then maybe play us an example?
Yeah. I'm glad you said one-night stand. I keep trying to think of this as a stand-up. It's like it's going to be comedy, so, but it's the one-night stand, is what they're calling it. It's going to be part travelogue. It's going to be part guitar lesson. There's going to be some natural history involved. That's a very interesting place that I went to, and I'll talk about that. It's actually a nature preserve where they held the workshop. There's going to be live music. I'll play some of Alex's recorded music for contrast. There's a little bit of geography mixed in, and there's going to be some kind of wacky stuff.
Wacky stuff.
So it's going to be quite a variety of things tonight.
Oh, sounds like fun. Well, you want to play something for us?
Yeah, I'll give it a try here. During one of the sessions with Alex Degrassi there, he played just a knockout version of Midnight After Midnight. I'm losing who the jazz musician was at After Midnight. Anyway, and I said, Alex, boy, that's dynamite. Can I get a copy of the score for that? And he says, well, I haven't written that one up yet, but how about Georgia on My Mind? And I said, well, yeah, I love the way you play that too. And I had a recording of his. Thelonious Monk is who I was trying to think of After Midnight there. So, anyways, Alex gave me the score for Georgia on My Mind, and I'll try a little bit of that here. That's the version that Alex sent to me, and then if you listen to his recorded version, he goes on and does variations on it. So that's kind of a takeoff point, and that works right into what some of the stuff that we did in the workshops was. How do you do variations? Where do you go from a standard version? So That's my next chore. I've learned the basic score, so now I'll take off from there.
How is Alex in person?
You know, he's a very personable guy. One of the things that I, after talking to some of the other guys in the workshop, and they were almost all guys. There was one woman, one young woman, and 11 guys. They were impressed, as I was, by the way Alex could listen to somebody play their piece. Because we went around in a circle in the master class, and Alex would listen intently, and then he could go back to say, well, that part back there where he just was, and he described just where he wanted to work on a part. But it was amazing the memory that he had for something that he heard for the first time, to go back in and work a certain section. Everybody was just blown away by that. He's a very intuitive musician. he's also a great improviser, too. There was a guy named Michael Day, who's a New York City guitarist, who came by for one of the sessions, and the two of them started jamming together. And that was just incredible. That was just awesome to hear him do that. He's a very energetic guy. Very sympathetic, though. I mean, he realized you're going to get people all across the spectrum in these workshops. As I say, we had two classical guitarists in there. We had people from young to old, all different types of music that they played, some that were just totally into open tunings. So he's very versatile, very personable guy. He's a great guy to do a workshop with.
Good. I bet the folks at the Juno Arts and Humanities Council will be thrilled to hear that. That's a this is a great example of when one of the grants goes to great use. And tonight, here's Dan bringing this music back to our community. If you want to learn more about this, you can go to the Jack tonight from 5 to 7 and hear all about this, and probably some music and some wacky stuff.
Yeah, I guarantee you.
Well, Dan, thanks for coming on the show today.
Well, thanks for having me in, Scott.
Yeah, is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, just as I say, it's going to be quite a wide variety of stuff, so even if you're into natural history, come by. There'll be a good lesson there.
Cool, and you have two CDs. I'm holding the solo classical guitar CD. Is this also called Watermark?
No, Watercolor is the other.
Excuse me.
This is the second one. Watercolor is the second one.
All right, and you selected a tune that we can go out on. Tell us about what we're about to hear.
Oh, it's one of my favorite ones to listen to. It's called El Negrito by Antonio Lauro, a Venezuelan composer. It just really has a sweet sound to it. I like South American music.
All right. Thanks again, Dan.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Scott.
Some of the most familiar and easy to remember bird songs are those that sound like they could have been whistled by a human. Their quality and simplicity remind us of the sounds that we can make, even with our modest human whistling apparatus. The olive-sided flycatcher has one of the most distinctive and catchy songs on the continent. And many birders learn early on to pick out its sharply inflected three-note song and to imitate it. The Eastern Peewee has a catchy tune, too. Pretty much whistling out its name, Peewee. A bit harder to imitate, though. But it's not only little songbirds that whistle. This nighttime whistler's a northern saw-whet owl. We like to think that owls only hoot, but these sound a lot like human whistles and are easy to copy. Finally, here's a bird that whistles its heart out. These shrill notes belong to a little seabird, the pigeon guillemot. Cousin to the puffins, whistling over the waves along the Pacific coast.
Support for this station comes from Sitka's Fly-In Fish-In, offering 10 oceanfront rooms near downtown with a full-service bar, restaurant, wireless internet, and other amenities. Information is available at flyinfishin.com.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, January 12th, 2015. It's about 36 minutes after the hour, and Colette Costa is here with me now.
We're here for precision. This is public radio.
36 and 39 seconds.
Call now. Pledge now. 586-3636. Hi, everybody. Good afternoon, Scott Burton. You're doing a terrific job here on Juno Afternoon.
Thank you, Colette Costa.
You're welcome.
And here we are to talk about the Goldtown Nickelodeon Theater.
Golly gee.
35mm movies.
So we might as well. We're pretty sad over there. This weather befits our mood. In a way, we had a little soiree last night. We're clearing out our 35mm projector, which probably doesn't mean a lot to most people, but it should, kind of.
Why?
I don't know. I'm a troglodyte. I was probably born 50-100 years too late, but I'm gonna miss things like that. There's the tenseness of it. Is that a word?
Mm-hmm.
Make it up.
Tactileness.
It's mechanical. It's understandable. It works. It always works, no matter what. You know, it doesn't always work. Digital things, but digital things look really good, and they're saving someone a lot of money.
Do they look better?
Your average person probably won't notice.
Mm-hmm.
They unless they're on a, you know, just a really super high end. Digital projector with a 4K in a perfect place, yeah, it's going to look terrific. But if you're in a perfect place with an awesomely outkept 35mm, it's going to look great. I was just in Detroit a couple weeks ago for the holidays, and I set a goal for myself, and I went to the IMAX theater at the Henry Ford Museum. It's the largest IMAX screen in Michigan. It's enormous. It's three stories high, and I saw Interstellar there on 70mm film. It was phenomenal. It's one of the greatest movie experiences ever. A good movie, but the experience itself out of the ballpark. Probably most people there would not have noticed if it was being played on digital. So some of it's just sort of hanging on to old times, and I'm very attached to the 35. It's, you know, it's what I studied in film school, and it's just a great, I guess, old-fashioned thing. And I also don't like being told what to do. That's a bigger part of it.
I think back to the transition from film to digital, just still photography, and a lot of people argued that slides, for example, film slides, provided deeper colors.
For sure.
Compared to digital. Is there an argument there with film as well?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that that's been made by the film fetishists, if you want to call them that. I think there's definitely a depth to it that's different, just like there is from a digital photograph to a film photograph. I think you can certainly see differences. But a lot of that's going to come down to the kind of film you've used, who's developing it, how your photography skills are. All those things come into play. I think the upswing is that with digital production, you're going to see you're seeing a big rise in independent films because it's so much cheaper to make. And because of that, you're getting a higher quality product from independent film. And so the good side is we'll eventually have access to really good independent product because there's simply going to be more of it. But right now the transition is it's still in the beta phase, really, and probably in a couple of years all these machines we're going to get all new ones.
Walk us through what it's like getting a film on 35 millimeter. Everything.
Really? You got an hour?
Yeah.
you ready to fall asleep?
I mean, they're big and heavy, right?
I send an email out. They're big and heavy, yeah. So Interstellar was 8 reels, which means it comes in 2 big shipping boxes in 20-minute increments on small, like 2-foot-wide film reels. And we have a bigger reel that can hold up to 2.5 hours, as we found out with this movie. And we build it piece at a time and basically tape it together, tape all the ends together to build one solid film and that we can show. And then same thing when we send it back out, we break it back down again. And our poor UPS man has to lug these 45, 50-pound boxes out the door. He's very happy about digital. UPS is extremely happy. So, I mean, and all the process will be pretty much exactly the same. I get a hold of a distributor. They get me a movie. Instead of sending me film, they're going to send me a hard drive. If we can make the conversion. That's going to be the big obstacle. So these conversions are very expensive, and they're fairly easy. It's like installing a new computer, essentially. But it's a very big computer, and it comes with about a $60,000 price tag.
What about projection?
What about it? What do you mean?
What will you have to upgrade in that category?
Oh, well, it's a whole package. So
okay.
You have to get their servers, their projectors, their everything. We'll still keep our little, you know, we have a little prosumer projector that we use for Blu-rays. We'll keep that for all the other side things that we do. But everything will come from them. So this will be a 2K projector, which is the amount of lines and lumens it sends out, blah, blah, blah. And for a small little theater like ours, it's going to look terrific. We have a small distance that the image has to throw, and it'll, honest to God, other than the clicking noise coming from behind your head, it's going to look the same, essentially. It's just the nature of it, I guess, that's different. And the fact that it's being forced on us. And, of course, Gross Alaska already went through this. They already, you know, and they had to pay $70,000, $80,000 per screen. It wasn't like you get one machine. And it's all done top down. So this was a decision that was made from the top because it saved the producers a metric ton of money, and none of that savings gets passed on to us. It's going to cost us the same amount to ship this.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the easy version. And it was just a long, you know, Lyle built this theater back in 98, and he made a 35 millimeter film to show. And you know, it's pretty amazing that a town this size has an independent art house theater. And it's primarily thanks to him for keeping it going for 10, 12 years. And so he came by last. In fact, all the projectionists, with the exception of two, who have ever projected in this town, for us anyway, came to this little thing we had last night. We were all up in the booth, had a little toast to Esmeralda, and then everybody went down to watch the movie. And after that, I did my little intro in the film, and I was like, okay, and let's roll it. And we looked up, and there's nobody in the booth. 6 projectionists on the floor. Okay, guess I'll go do it myself. It was a sweet little thing. So we're going to start launching a big fundraising campaign, try and get a little help going to keep the lights on, basically.
All right.
I know. Pledge now, 586-2875.
What else is going on at the Gold Town right now?
We got a hell of a lineup, just a heck of a lineup. We are going to do, I can't let the Interstellar go yet. We had the whole thing last night, and you know, there were so many awesome people there, I literally didn't get a chance to sit down and watch even a minute of the movie. So I'm playing it again for myself. Tomorrow night, 6:30. Anybody else want to join me? $9 for a ticket. So there'll be one more Interstellar show, one more Tommy Lee Jones show tonight, and then we open Foxcatcher tomorrow, which is going to be phenomenal. That's the Steve Carell wrestling movie. And then after that, we get Whiplash, which is awesome jazz movie with that hot little J.K. Simmons. He's not really young. Anyway, sidetracked. And we got a K&N concert coming up. We have, what don't we have, Scott? You know, we don't have is like a couple live goats and a snake charmer. That's all we're short right now. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If somebody wants to find out more information, where should they go?
I don't know. Come and see me. GoldTownNick.com would be good. That's the best place. We have a Facebook page somewhere. You know how I feel about that. That's probably the best place. Or just listen to Juno Afternoon every two or three days. Here I am. La-dee-dee, la-dee-da. Website's the best place. And, keep your eyes open. We have all kinds of, we're booked through March right now. I got a great lineup all the way through March. We have the Oscar shorts coming up. We have a bunch of concerts, some parties. And we're going to launch our fundraiser February 1st. And then we got the Oscars next month. I'm just worn out. Plum tuckered out, son.
Colette Costa, co-owner. And do you have another title, like executive director of the Gold Town President?
I like El Presidente.
El Presidente.
La Reina is fitting. She who captivates those with a net. I don't know.
Thanks for coming in, Colette.
Oh, Scott, you're so welcome. Thanks, Yuya. You'll love you.
Listening to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, January 12th. I'm your host, Scott Burden. In the studio now is the Assistant General Manager of Arts and Culture, Cheryl Snyder. Welcome, Cheryl.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me in today.
Yeah. Thanks for being here. You and I are co-producers of Writers Showcase, this fun new show on Arts at 360, 360 North.
Yeah, I think you just calculated that the next program we're going to be producing is our fifth in the series. For those of you who are not familiar with Writers Showcase, we based it on Selected Shorts. It's a program that airs Tuesday nights on K2 News. Essentially, we solicit pieces of writing from authors from all over the state. We do want Alaskan authors. And we are looking for short stories. We often get personal essays, but we love the fiction stories. And we're looking for stories that are set around a given theme that we've come up with for the program. For our next recording, what date are we doing that, Scott?
We're doing that March 20th is when we'll record.
Yep. So for that show, our theme is journeys, and we invite all stories, whether they be fiction or nonfiction, to explore that theme in some way. We love liberal interpretation of the theme. You can get as creative as you want, but we create these themes just to give some sort of foundation to the show. But again, you can take it wherever you want.
Absolutely. And about 10 minutes when read aloud works best.
Yeah, that's kind of the sweet spot. If you have a really great story that times out longer, we can work with it. We've had some pieces that are 18 minutes long. We've had other pieces that are about 6 minutes long. But if you think about 10 minutes as what we're going for, that's a good place to shoot for.
Absolutely. And like Selected Shorts, we have actors read the pieces.
Yeah, we've had some questions about that. Why do we choose the actors? And we certainly have had some of the writers read their pieces over the course of the programs we've already produced. But we choose the actors for a couple reasons, or maybe it's like one main reason. It's just that they are trained to really bring the pieces to life, and that's what we're looking for. This is entertainment for radio. It's a TV product. You can be a really great writer, but maybe you're shy in front of a group. And we have found that with some of our writers, that it's awkward for them. And I also think that having someone other than yourself read your piece, they find nuance and meaning in it that maybe as a writer you just take for granted or overlook. So really, we choose these actors to present them, and it really, really, really makes the stories fun to listen to and really come alive.
Yeah, I think in that sense it becomes a collaboration between two artists, right?
Yeah, yeah, and that's been really fun. At times we've had the writers in talking with the actors. We get pieces from all over the state, so at other times it's also just a practical reason why we have the actors there, because we can't have, you know, it's not convenient for someone to come in from Kotzebue to read their story or what have you, but... Yeah, so that's why we do that, and it's just been really fun.
So as an example, if you haven't heard or seen one of our productions of Writer Showcase, we have a piece right here I'm going to play for you. It's from our show that was themed Endurance back in, what was it, June of 2014
yep.
when we did that? And you're going to hear a short story called Sweet Sunny South, written by Joe Carson and read by Ryan Conroe.
Samantha and I lie on the beach. We are in the deepest possible south with its sneaky, brutal sun. This is not the sun I expected. I'd pictured the big yellow ball in a child's drawing, the sun of a perfect sunny-side-up egg smiling down from the blue sky on honeysuckle, hummingbirds, and Uncle Remus. The Gulf sky is seldom blue. The sun is everywhere but unseen, hiding in the haze, working me over. I imagine that it's punishing me for being so awkward, for not knowing the local ways, the slow and easy style. It's July 1962, and I've just celebrated my birthday. I'm now 17, I'm a Yankee, and a semi-virgin. I thought it would be simple. One day you're a virgin, and the next day you're not. My problem is that my first attempts at sex were so clumsy that I'm not sure they really counted. In a way, I hope they didn't. If my accomplishments in bed to this point were the real thing, then I figure the whole business is highly overrated. Still, a man is supposed to keep score. Nothing, it seems, is simple anymore. I watch Samantha perfectly still on her towel. The blasting heat does not bother her. It wouldn't dare. Samantha is a genuine Southern belle, and even the elements must show a proper respect.
I just love that piece. That whole show, we had some really great fiction pieces. That piece in particular was wonderful. You can, actually, if you want to listen to the rest of it and see the rest of that program, you can go to 360north.org, click under Arts at 360, and you'll find all of the things that we've been creating here in the arts and culture and our arts and culture wing here at the station. But, yeah, so, again, we are looking for pieces around the theme of journeys for the next program we're doing. And maybe you yourself are a writer and you'd like to throw your piece in for submission. If you know of other writers, again, we are looking for Alaskans from all over the state to be a part of this program. So if you don't write but you've got a friend somewhere up north or someone south of here who you think might be interested, please do send them to 360north.org for more information on Writer Showcase.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you have a piece that you want to submit, please do submit it to arts@ktoo.org. And sometimes we work with writers to get those pieces ready to go.
I guess one more question I'll answer that we have gotten is, you know, how does this differ from, say, mudrooms? And the difference is that mudrooms is a great venue to get up and tell personal stories. What Scott, you and I have created here is really about the written word. And it's great storytelling. It's also about the prose. So I think that's the main distinction.
Absolutely. So again, that deadline is February 27th. The theme is journeys. Metaphorical,
that wherever you want.
literal, however you want. And just also, we're going to have one more show at the end of the 2014-15 broadcast season. We're calling it Writer's Choice, and that will be in June. So it's an open theme. So
that's
think
right.
About that, too. arts@ktoo.org. Are we missing anything, Cheryl?
I think that's it, Scott. I think we got it.
All right.
Thanks.
Any questions? Again, arts@ktoo.org. Thanks for coming on the show, Cheryl.
Yep, it's been fun. Thanks,
Scott. I promised him that I'd put it to good use. Lucky's 10 years older than me, and he's very concerned about my sex life. It seems like all the older men who I meet are. Samantha loves the car. She sits close, right up against me. When I drove Lucky's Chevy, she never sat that close. Soon as I park, Samantha removes the bubble gum from her mouth and places it in my hand. Now, the first time I was confronted with this ritual, I was ready to jump on the next Greyhound heading north. I was devastated. I figured I'd strayed too far. I entered a territory too alien for my survival. Was this a local gesture of acceptance or rejection? Was there a gum shortage? Did a proper gentleman periodically inspect a lady's bubble gum to make sure it was still fit for her to chew? Now I'm perfectly at ease with the gum business. I actually enjoy it. According to Samantha, it's not ladylike or bell-like to dispose of one's own gum. This is a man's job, and the whole thing must be handled discreetly and without fanfare. Holding the sweet pink gum still warm from Samantha's mouth gives me a...
comes from GCI, using social media to keep customers up to date with maintenance updates, community events, products, services, and more. On Facebook at Facebook/GCIAK, Twitter handle, and Instagram, GCIAK.
Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, January 12th. It's about 2 minutes until the top of the hour. Currently 36 degrees at the airport, 38 degrees at the federal building. And speaking of the weather, tonight rain lows around 36, southeast wind 10 miles per hour. Tuesday, rain highs around 42, southeast wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. Wednesday, rain highs around 43, southeast wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. And looks like rain likely on Friday as well. Stay tuned here in a few for All Things Considered.